Good evening. Thank you for coming, especially with the first rain we've had in 19 years for the Amy Award, so it must have some significance. We're here to celebrate poetry and my daughter, Amy Elizabeth Rothholz, which is where the Amy Award name comes from. I want to thank the library for this absolutely splendid setting and poets and writers whose efforts make the event possible. And I guess most people do read the Times, at least this company. And the debate over poetry as a luxury continues, as always. It is supposedly not part of the real world, but if I had a motto or a bumper sticker, it would say stamp out reality. But Jimmy Ernst, I think, said it best. Artists and poets are the raw nerve of humanity. By themselves, they can do very little to save the world, but without them, there would be little worth saving. Tonight we have a group of raw nerves, all of whom, I think, and that of my fellow judge, my husband, Edward Boucher, who's also a poet, I think they have the heart of what makes a true poet, and I do believe that they are born poets, not made. Any fine-tuning they need will come with aging. And I want to thank them for their talent and their courage in entering the fierce arena. And again, I must, as I say every year, they're always beautiful. They do not send photographs with their entries, but they're always beautiful. And just to give you some advice from Macaulay, perhaps no person can be a poet or even enjoy poetry without a certain unsoundness of mind. So all of you who are enjoying it, be careful. And having said that, of course, I want to thank our honored guest, Kimiko Hahn, for agreeing to read her very fine work tonight. And now I turn the program over to Elliot Figman, who is Director of Poets and Writers. And this is an organization that, if you really care about the arts, deserves your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Paula. Thank you and Ed for making this possible. It's always a very special treat. This year, I have a note to myself to remind everybody to turn off your phones, okay? If you haven't turned off your phone, please do so. This year is a little bit different in that the judges, that is Paula and Ed, could not restrain themselves to choosing just four winners, okay? They wanted to have a special citation, okay, for one poet whose name is Katie Tan, who I just had the pleasure of meeting a few minutes ago. Katie is a senior at Great Neck High, and in addition to poetry, she's very interested in theater, and she's going to kick off the poetry with a poem of hers. So, Katie.
Hi, this poem is Hit Me. I originally intended it to be a spoken word poem, but I'll do my best. Yeah. Thank you. So hit me. Love is a violent thing. It cracks you open and lets your inside spill outside, lining your name, your face, your will to pull yourself together, filling spaces that had only dust before. The world doesn't hold back. It winds up and kicks you in the teeth, pulls you up by your hair and screams in your face. I learned it early, that you can't love without breaking something. Zeros are damned hard to draw when you hold the pencil in the wrong hand. They don't call the left hand right for a reason, but they never told me why. My teacher broke it in half, the pencil, not the hand, and gave me the side without the eraser. I cried. There were so many zeros to draw, so many fears to wipe away that blurred the crooked lines. In Bayside, the duplex that kept the rain off seven backs was too small for even just me and my ego. I had to be trained to make myself small with a leather belt across my palm, my thigh, my face. I was like a wild horse, bucking like a California quake, throwing cowboys off my back, thinking that this must be what a revolution looks like. This must be what a revolution feels like. His back hit the lockers so hard that my teeth rattled, and my hairs raised like the voices that stood still, not touching him, not touching me. Boy, I didn't know. Girl, I didn't know. Boy, who's all the things I ever knew. My left hand yanked out and reached for the arm that shoved. My eyes found eyes that dripped with blame. Mine said, I learned how to forget my skin for stinging me when it hurt me, so take your best shot. Hit me. I already know how to laugh. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. Our guest poet is Kimiko Han, who is the author of 9 collections of poetry, most recently, very recently, Brain Fever, which is just out from W.W. Norton, and I think there are bookmarks, okay, on the table to my left. You can pick those up afterwards. Kimiko is the recipient of many awards, including fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Guggenheim Foundation. She is the distinguished professor in the MFA program in creative writing and literary translation at Queen's College. Kimiko Han's poems are tender, tough, brazen, and intelligent. They draw you in like the best told of stories and lead you always on a journey filled with adventure, intrigue, and surprise. In addition to being a highly accomplished poet, Kimiko happens to be a mensch, a wonderful person, okay? So please welcome Kimiko Han.
Thank you, Elliot, from one mensch. Thank you for inviting me to participate this evening and celebrating Amy's book, Iced Tigers, and all these young women here as well. I'm going to open with a poem by Amy Rothatz. And it's a villanelle. Her form, her formal poetry is especially captivating. Villanelle. Dying negatives burn in the backdoor sun. Accomplished desires bring no sense of relief. My loving your smile is only for fun. The dungaree poet is on the run. Iced tigers have chosen nothing instead of grief. Dying negatives burn in the backdoor sun. Lime water recall seems too well done. Jethro's daughter sighs in disbelief. My loving your smile is only for fun. The matador furtively wets his gun. Wrong number summers quiet the thief. Dying negatives burn in the backdoor sun. The pencil actress will be the one. Her China doll pills preserve daddy's belief. My loving your smile is only for fun. The blind man's race is already being won. Afternoon sands are always too brief. Dying negatives burn in the backdoor sun. My loving your smile is only for fun. That was so lovely. It's a pleasure for me to read from my brand new book. Came out last week. The past two books that I've written have most of the work has been inspired by, triggered really, by science, especially the science section of the New York Times. And they know, the editors know that I'm, you know, in my little room taking their articles and having my way with them. So Toxic Flora, my previous book, I would take one article and write a poem, and then for Brain Fever, I would, for the most part, take one article and write a sequence. And most of those articles happen to be on cognitive science, which I still know nothing about. But as I say, they triggered the poems. So I want to begin with actually a semi-random one. No, I'm not. I'm going to begin with The Dream of Parsnips. This is from the Dream Sequence, which is based on an article on dream theory. And for this sequence, I made up a little form for myself to keep the engine going. I had to repeat a word or words, keep the poem under 20 lines, más o menos, and have some kind of quote from the dream theory article. So it's probably more than you need to know. The Dream of Parsnips. Do I wish for a box of cigars or dynamite? Do I wish for the sudden squirming of earthworms? Do I wish for the dense smell in Grandma Ida's dining room or some prefix? Do I wish for the standing outside his lit office window at 2 a.m. as only a sophomore can stand? Or for the husband to scrap the skank? Or perhaps for the researcher herself who believes dreaming is not a parallel state, but consciousness itself in the absence of the senses' input. Considering various explanatory projects, I do wish that wishing would process whatever calls up an object so white and duplicitous. So I would begin with an object, the dream of an object, and then I would just let the associations go. So some are personal associations and some popular culture, etc. The dream of a pillow. Zealous mother or breast? Zealous marshmallow, zealous feathers. Although the neuroscientist does not declare, so what? She does believe the brain observes prop and scene in a lucid watchfulness, which may play out in proverb or verse, or may be utterly meaningless. Zealous codeine, zealous noose. The dream of knife, fork, and spoon. I can't recall where to set the knife and spoon. I can't recall which side to place the napkin or which bread plate belongs to me or how to engage in benign chatter. I can't recall when more than one fork, which to use first, or what to make of a bowl of water. I can't see the place cards or recall any names. The humiliation is impressive, the scorn. No matter how much my brain revises the dinner to see if the host was a family member, I can't recall which dish ran away with which spoon. This is a one-off, it's not from cognitive science. Ode to Home. Snails are such a pick-me-up, and Darwin thought so too, though he was greatly perplexed by the existence of the Roman land snail. How How could a creature so readily killed by salt contrive to populate oceanic islands? In his room, he submerged them in seawater until egg and snail survived these long baths, surmising that the lowly Helix pomatia must have been transported to islands by adhering to driftwood or the feet of birds. I, too, contrive to lug a house on my shoulders, since it finally protects against origin. The dream of a lacquer box. I wish I knew the contents, and I wish the contents Japanese. Like hairpins made of tortoiseshell or bone, though my braid was lopped off long ago. Like overpowering pine incense or a talisman from a Kyoto shrine. Like a Hello Kitty diary lock and key, Hello Kitty stickers or candies, a netsuke in the shape of a squid, ticket stubs from a double suicide movie. Or am I wishing for mother, searching for sister, just hoping to give something Japanese to my daughters? Then again, people can read anything into dreams, and I do as well. I wish I possessed my mother's black lacquer box, though in my dream it was red, though I wish my heart were content. So here's where I have a lot of fun with the fight with the color red, or the word, the sound red. The dream of a fire engine. Without the sun filtering through closed eyelids, without the siren along the service road, without grandpa's ginger-colored hair, mother's lipstick, daughter's manicure, firecrackers, a monkey's ass, a cherry, Ray's lost elephant, without past tense, deficit, or communist, without Mao's favorite novel about a chamber, or the character seeing her own chopped-off feet dancing in fairy slippers, or the siren at a hot sheet motel with a prof, the scientist of sleep has claimed that without warm blood, a creature cannot dream. Excuse me for flipping here. Giraffes. It's from the puzzle section. After skimming the Sunday Times, Dad turned to the back of the magazine and tore out the crossword puzzle for his mother in Wisconsin, as routine as my calligraphy class on Saturdays, flute practice exactly 20 minutes on school nights, and astringent twice a day. I loved the ideas of puzzles, but never tried my hand as problem solving rubbed up against rivalry. Red velvet cake, red velvet dress, trilling, because nothing was never enough, and yet more than a small rectangular lawn and the pulsing marsh beyond. A puzzle might have been escape enough, a maze instead of crossword. No, crosswords were our puzzles, after all, although my sister and I adored jigsaw puzzles. 500, a zoo, I think, giraffes, absolutely. The dream of a raindrop. Whether tear or rain, neither appear round on search engine images, even though scientifically speaking, the latter begins as a liquid globe, aggregates of water molecules that have condensed around specks of dust or salt until gravity has its way and circle turns into chandelier crystal. Drizzle, downpour, tempest. Come inside, Kimmy, before you catch your death. I'm sorry, this advanced galleys doesn't have page numbers, so a little bit, okay. Black kite, white plastic. You might consider plastic a convenience, a waste, or deferred payment. For black kites, white plastic is vital decor, indicating the resident a superior strategist. Before plastic, perhaps cloth or paper. Before these, maybe brightly colored feathers of other birds, the white wool of sheep or deer, or perhaps the behavior evolved after such materials became available, offers an ornithologist. Only the right amount of white plastic, not green or transparent, serves as warning to those threatening foreclosure. I reconsider our pugnacious white lawn chair in wonder. I'm going to close with two more, and these are both kind of one-offs. They're not part of any sequence. The morphology of flowers. Even Darwin saw the evolution of flowers as an abominable mystery, and in current experiments on ancient appendage-building genes, a scientist reasserts that mutations set off grotesque changes, that is, things grow where they do not belong. Thus, the petals of water lilies are not in and of themselves radical or mysterious. What is radical and mysterious is the evolution of fancy as she dusts off fossil fragments to examine an early impression, small, rare, and growing in the shadow of the then more successful, distant cousin to the pine, daughter-in-law of the star anise, concubine of the ginkgo. And I'll end with cherry stems, which is dedicated to my daughters. I'm not too happy that fruit flies have brains, since I swat them whenever I see them or think I see them. I know about their brains because I met a scientist who tinkers with their learning circuitry, the actual mechanics of how a memory trace is laid down in a nerve cell or neuron. All this proxy, dissecting the behavior of an insect to figure out how the brain works for something like typing, at which my mother was a pro, and me fairly miserable because of some disorder, which it seems my daughter has inherited, since she also exhibits left-right confusion. However, she can twist a cherry stem into a bow with her tongue, an ability no doubt from an ancestral brain, but which also reveals something about a summer in Florence. In other words, too much information regarding memory trace. Thank you.
Thank you, Kimiko. So our first winner tonight is Jerry Choi, who was born in New Orleans and completed her education in Hong Kong, Spain, and Los Angeles. Since moving to New York in 2007, she has performed at the first and second annual New York Poetry Festivals, as well as the Brooklyn Folk Music Festival. She lives in Brooklyn, where she continues to thrive as a poet, country blues musician, and herbalist. Please welcome Jerry Choi.
I'm going to start with a poem by Amy Rothholz. It's in her book, Ice Tigers, and it's called Chance Meeting. The name has no basis. Protecting the innocent does not apply. Although the Oriental witch concerns herself with the physicality of non-existence, do not dwell on non-essentials. Shells, bones, sandcastle etchings, you cannot knock down, drag out, change what is not there. The day's emptiness is distributed into bottles of colored smoke that are uninformative. Things are already known. Yet you are unaware of the spreading of shaven legs, the eye in his chest, the quilted light balancing precariously behind the door. Now I'm going to read a poem of mine that's called Gift. You give me bracelets of little eggplant bruises, sewing my skin with my favorite color. And in my garden they grow in hungry, malignant shades. Mustard yellow, avocado green, the pregnant black of mold. And with your hands, you water them. You do not know that the little tendrils of their plant toes have penetrated my bones, snaking deeper towards my coveted marrow. You do not know that my pure white bones become more precious every day as your children chisel them with the agonizing imagination of an archaeologist who will one day split open an entryway to the forbidden catacombs of my chromosomes. Next is a poem called Getty. White, all white straight lines and concrete where we can't even find the art, although we look for hours, and all there is to do is lie down on the grass in this preposterous garden, symmetrical and absurdly shaved, a doll's rubber crotch smiling at the sun. And there's a plastic voice in my head, a plastic smell in the air, and when I run my hands through the green hair of the grass, it comes out covered in little pastel green balls. There's nothing for it but to melt away in this sauce of hydrocarbons, of ugly and sinister little guards in suits and ties, who creep up behind us well-meaning museum patrons to whisper, "Not exactly." Enough to get you out of here forever. Melt into the bubbling sauce of mediocre and immaculate mannequins, of tinfoil and titanium colors, immortal as dead gods and as cold as Christ. Enough to last through a nuclear Shoah. And something comes out of a stranger's hand spreading over my sanity like a flower, flowing black as ants. Over there on the green hill, a couple is playing. Rolling over and over, they are at least 60 years old, and her dress flies up, presenting us with her wise and ancient ass. They stare at us secretly, knowingly. And suddenly I understand the meaning of the bird's eye, covered with a milky film as its offspring peck and peck, of the rising ribs of a dog, beautiful and supine, immaculately cleansed by love and the vultures. You and I are here, and we are also the 60-year-olds humping on that hill. But inside, they are slipping backwards into the warm dark where nothing awaits. And I have felt this as clear as steel, seen the stars peel back one by one to reveal nothing. And so this means you and I are golden, we are young, and we are also dying, thank God. The ghosts in my head line up. The ghosts in my head line up, jostling each other, stepping on each other's heels, and misbehaving in general, as they try to pass one by one before my eyes so I can let them exit onto the page. Never is there a tranquil moment. Never is there peace in the hall of ghosts. Never does anybody clean up after them. Never does anyone bury the dead. So the old limbs get mixed in with the new, and a graveyard experiment of past and present often leaps shamelessly into my private quarters. An old one shuffles by in tattered complimentary hotel slippers and raps on the one-way mirror with yellow hooked nails. A young one stands in his shadow, unseen, and contemplates embracing his old wrinkled neck with the silk cord of her dressing gown. Instead, she glides towards him, burning his ear with these words, "I can either squeeze off your head, or we can lie down together and make love. Which would you prefer?" Fable. Listen, can you hear the tangle vine singing to she who whistles through 30 holes in her beak? That is how she draws her prey. My grandmother slipped underground, an accident. Is she gone? Really? Why does nobody say anything? It is normal, dwelling in beds and doorways, rooms and graves. I go walking in the garden, the sun full-fledged. Orange flesh is springing from pregnant trees. Nature persists in circles. Toad-skinned fruit gazes from the damp earth, aboriginal eyes of a bird I once knew. We are all afraid to take one from the hanging tree. Screams, look at these thighs, I gave my flesh away. It is our protection from the infinite. Her bed was stolen by the grass. The square is a human invention. Skin on her eyes, moss on stone. I was there that day. Yes, I tell you, I was. Grandmother removes her dress, and the perfume of white clay seals my throat, vinegar deep. The body unzips, a wrinkled peel, blessing my upturned face. I think again of the simurgh, sacred bird born a million times from her own egg, and curled fingers unhatched, hovering, close. Abuelita drifting down through the pot of oily broth, wings crossed. Abuelita floating with the flies in the dog's bowl, moss-blessed and holy. Abuelita moving me as worms do, her fingers inside mine, teaching the two-step to my blessed bones. Abuelita, my mouth is your paw, a rose pressed between the leaves of my lips. Your featherless wings wrap the tongues of strangers, we crouch in the corner. There is no room for those still perched on branches, beyond the wound's clenched fist. The swollen organs of virginal oranges, bruised soft, are rotten. All things round are under suspicion of harboring immortality. There is no room. Listen, I was there that day. Yes, I tell you, I was. We crouch in the corner as she removes her dress, moving me as the worms do, with curled fingers unhatched, hovering close. She screams, look at these thighs, I gave my flesh away. That is how she draws her prey. Wings crossed, she slips underground, moss-blessed, holy, and vinegar deep. A gaze from the damp earth and the perfume of white clay seals my throat. It was an accident. Drifting down through the pot of oily broth, a million times born from her own egg, is she gone? Really? Simurgh, perpetual bird, featherless wings wrap the tongues of strangers like moss on a stone. Orange flesh springs from pregnant trees, floating with flies in the dog's bowl. You are still perched on branches, aboriginal eyes of a bird I once knew. It was an accident, your fingers in mine, my mouth your paw. Skin grows on eyes like toad-skinned fruit and beds are stolen by the grass. Nature persists in circles, but the square is a human invention. We dwell in beds, doorways, rooms, and graves. It is our protection from the infinite. All things round are under suspicion of harboring immortality. The body unzips, a wrinkled peel. Why does nobody say anything except the tangle vines singing to she who whistles through 30 holes in her beak? Can you hear the two-step dance, my blessed bones? I go walking through the garden in the full-fledged sun, a rose pressed into the leaves of my lips. The swollen organs of virginal oranges, bruised soft and rotten, bless my upturned face. We are all afraid to take one from the hanging tree. One more now. I wrote this poem in a fit of rage, and I'm going to read it now for the first time to an audience. The Edible Woman. The table crouches on all fours, like the woman perched upon it. Come all you aunts, uncles, godfathers, sons, it's time to eat. Sharpen knives and polish forks. Have some bread to dip into the warm gravy, quickly. Angel hair can get soggy if you let it sit for too long. She sickens, too. Her flesh bears the imprints of those grabbing fingers longer than the dough you decline to knead. She was kneaded, too, by woman. For you, of course. Who else? Start with the lips, you know that much. The best ones are plump and curved for your pleasure. The breasts, too, are good, stuck through with a spit and basted for several hours. You can do it. Fingers are a delicacy often preferred in Eastern cultures, but for us Americans, too much gelatin, too much skin and joint tissue. But they say it's good for the formation of tendons and cartilage, as Mother Nature provides all that is needed. Neck, now that's a pleasure, with wisps of hair innocently damp and curled, hair that can be saved for a trophy or better, used to bind the legs together for a nice trussed-up roast. Oh yes, the legs, let's not forget. We want the knees nice and hard, but thighs and calves well-rounded. Hard to find the perfect legs, frustrating really, although they are only stilts for those deepest of delights, the ass, and the oysters in between. While some love it and some hate it, it depends if you tolerate seafood and especially shellfish, but make sure you sauce it well first. And that's only the beginning. Think about the mons, the sweetmeats, the kidneys, the ovaries fried in some of that back fat sliced thin and sputtering in the pan and sprinkled with grated parm. Eyes steamed and swallowed whole bring mystical powers of creativity and clairvoyance. Cheeks battered and toasted and served with turnip cakes, au jus, and the succulent tenderloin tartare. The softest skin on the body is there. Suck it down while you can. The suppleness of the skin fades quickly once the surrounding nerves and capillaries feed into nothingness. It's rather humorous, I know. We may think on it and grin. I'll feed on woman in the womb, and freed, we do it again. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Alexandra Smith lives in Brooklyn with her husband and their black cat, Bandini. She is a graduate of the City College of New York MFA Creative Writing Program and the 2013 recipient of the Jerome Lowell DeJure Award in Poetry, currently at work on her first poetry manuscript. Please welcome Alexandra Smith.
I just wanted to say thank you to Poets and Writers, and thank you to Ms. Trackman for having me. Excuse me. It's such an honor to be included among such incredible women. This is an amazing event. I'm so grateful to be here. I'm going to open my reading with an untitled poem of Amy's. And those of you who know me will know why I chose it. Green cats caress my legs at 6 o'clock. The slinky sun dances in burning streets, and the last tango ends with freckled feet. You come at 12, fueling the burning block. Another night of candlelight and bones, remains of battle, bones. The war is silent. To melt into your side is intent. I watch you drown in dreams. I cry alone. My tears come from laughter, from too much gin. Darkness hugs me, dispelling the loneliness. My tiny pink-red bed tastes of blonde smoothness. I put it in my mouth. Gray dawn slides in. Bloom. 16, heavy with the scent of sex and cotton candy, I sat in their basement rec room, studying the wood-paneled walls while the TV talked to itself and the children slept upstairs. Sisters, they knew well enough to be frightened of me, shrieking with giddy horror each time my cream-colored bra strap snaked its way out from beneath my shirt. They sensed this dangerous ripeness, the incessant blooming that was without control. I fed them toaster waffles and melting ice cream, begged them to let me French braid their hair. They shrank from my touch, fearing my ceaseless burgeoning was contagious. I sat in lonely fever, my body a barrier separating me from the rest of the world. Later, walking home, I listened to the crickets and cicadas catcalling, fingered the 20s in my pocket, tried to forget their father's hand lingering on my back just a second too long. Morsel. I keep reaching for that clever spark, a compulsive sensation, that particular pattern of attention that binds over everything you do, like some charming weed. It's better not to mention this waiting, my heart a tender little morsel cured in the juices of my longing. Swallow it with a sip of your drink, the tang pairing well with your whiskey. Let it settle in that pit. Feel the flutter and kickstart of slept upon furies, that glorious ache of being filled slowly from bottom to top. The things I carried. The desire for visible clavicles, stoked by the endless hunger of the middle child, was a gently repeating whisper in the pastel ether of 14. Later, I would gorge myself on the solid outlines of men's bodies on top of me, allowing for a few moments the sensation of delicacy, never not aware of the space my flesh occupied. Self-help books called this starvation. I called it prayer. I am always seeking pressure, conflating fragility with worthiness. Alone at night, I can feel their bodies strung out like a set of rosary beads, muscles smoothed by the worrying of my greedy fingers. How ravenously I consumed each of them, my brief attempts at attaining that holy emptiness I lacked. Is for lovers. August takes Virginia slow and heavy. The state leans in with a feline stretch. Hyacinths bloom in reverse. Everything bends, absorbing the weight of water. Nothing to do but wait this out. Nothing to do but let the heat pull the air. I think you are a fever dream. I imagine the way cinnamon meets honey. I feel warm sunlight casting shadows through tree branches in a cemetery. Nothing like this ever lasts. Make the beast. To receive is a form of compassion. You call my body like a suicide hotline 5, 6, 7 times a day. I want to call this indignity love, but it insists its name is hunger. It all feels the same. Your mouth chasms into yawn on the pillow next to mine. I fight the urge to stick my finger inside, the way I used to tease danger, touching the black rubber flaps of the garbage disposal with the tines of my mother's silver forks. I just want to make the beast inside purr, to press metal against grinding. God is in the details, the sticky hands of the 2-year-old down the street missing his right front tooth. I want to be angry at your demand, but you hold the door open and I feel myself sliding into the passenger seat and buckling myself in. I check my lipstick in the mirror as you lean across my legs to open the glove compartment, reassuring me that it is still there, that it is still loaded. Infidelity. I want you to treasure this miscommunication. Imagine a soft conflict, faintly sanitized by smoke. My desire, unconditional, explains this conflict. This is not something we can taper to our advantage. No more pussyfooting. I am begging to be enabled. Wrap me in your heat. Let the persecution commence. Seared. I am cradling a burn from touching a stove that was far too hot. It's luxurious, this pain. That power, the denial of the word no. I am a creature of the canyon, a small, dark collection of desires. Hunger is a form of yearning, and I only have appetite for those most artless cravings. What smolders within me is that fully wordless sin, cleft-tongued and gorgeous, beckoning me out of my skin. I want to sink into it like the sea, slip in over my head, surrounded by cool satin black. That kind of girl. This is a poem inspired by Kim Adonizio. 2 years and you'd still kill for a cigarette. You smile and tell your date you gave those up long ago. Told them you were just going to the corner store for another 6-pack of cheap beer, left your pack sitting out on the back porch with your torn dime store stockings and the ex-boyfriend with the facial scar, the sad one you just couldn't bring yourself to break up with. You tell yourself you had to do it, that self-respect means leaving behind those deviations you desired the most. And anyway, isn't the past just that? A lonely echo of your dark cravings? Isn't it better to be in this air-conditioned cafe with floral oilcloth on the table? You smooth your hair back into a bun and tell yourself you're enjoying this glass of white Zinfandel, ignoring the red manicured voice telling you to take the bottle and run, that it would taste better alone with a pack of smokes out on your fire escape, in your half-slip and bra, the June heat like lover's breath on the back of your neck. The voice that begs you to take your fuck-me pumps out of retirement in order to go into the streets in search of a man to ruin just one last time. But you're not that kind of girl anymore. You're just a girl having drinks with a nice man that you won't be taking home. And I'm going to close out with one of my more recent poems. This is called Exoskeleton Blues. One. It's that time of the month again. The moon is bulging out of its socket. My fillings shriek with pain, and everything is an insult. The skirt that no longer zips, the door that says pull that won't open when I push it, the coworker who insists on ending my name with an I like some kind of porn star when my email signature clearly shows I spell it with an IE. I want to be Alexandra, the patron saint of not giving a shit, but the creatures with shells are suffering, and I can't take this anymore. Two. I am one with the invertebrates, hoping for chitin and barnacles, armor of my own. I walk with my belly to my enemies. The only barrier between softness and the world is a pair of Spanx one size too small, waistband chewing a ring around my middle, telling my lovers, look how small I made myself for you, while the telltale stomach roll flaps smugly in the breeze. We are all crustaceans in the bedroom, and when I am in front of you, I feel too big for this skin, wishing I could molt. Three. The moon, that big old slut, pulls at the tides, and in turn, the tides pull on me. My body swells and deflates, bellwether of blood to come. I am always surprised at the elasticity of my skin, the network of silver stretch marks across my hip, a map, literally, of how far I've come. It's the human body's largest organ, and every 7 years it regenerates into something new. A lobster lives for 7 years and will shed its exoskeleton 20 to 25 times. The things that I could do if I was given fresh armor over 24 times. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexandra. Lindsay Stern's first book, Town of Shadows, was adapted into a dance in 2013 by Loud Hound Movement, a collective based in New York City. Her work has appeared or will appear in Pank, American Circus, and The Faster Times, among other publications. And her second book, Loose, is it Loose? Loose? Okay. Is forthcoming in 2015 from Ravenna Press. Please welcome Lindsay Stern.
Thank you all so much for coming, and thank you to Poets and Writers and to Amy's family. It's such an honor to be part of this group. There was a writer, and I forget who it was, but she said that a poem is never finished, it is only abandoned. And in that spirit, I'm going to read one of Amy's a set of Amy's fragments, which are poems in their own right. Fragments and first drafts. I don't count up days of your absence. They are of two kinds, either alike or not. The letter that I want to write to you is problematical for me to start. I try to gauge how far apart we are and see a vast parenthesis. Nobody lives in the present time, has textures past and future that tongues taste at, fingers feel for. The present happens in rooms I am not in. Past rooms are only momentarily empty. If I knew how to turn around, I would cross the threshold, smiling. Never look at your face traveling. Vision stops change. I hate myself in April, being mirrored in your defiant blue eyes. My red fear of open spaces does not prevent me from enjoying the pallor of August. The summer demands and takes away too much, but night, the reserved, the reticent, gives more than it takes. Goodbye, you say, until next time, and I build our climate until next time, but the sky frowns and the work gets completed in a dream. I'm going to read three poems of mine, and the first one I wrote using words taken from a tiny book about insects, and I created it by erasing every word in the book except for the ones you'll be hearing. History. In the beginning, time casts its skin. Patterns hatch. Children appear, particles of dust beset with eyes. All a cage of music till the seasons fall. There are two kinds of death. Next poem is called Elsewhere. The translators of Latin have buried their tongues in the aster, have buried themselves in the hills. Syllables thicken the autumn light. On the lawn, moths are blooming from the ghosts of worms, flooding the air with new wind. Two by two, the translators climb out of the hills, arrange the leaves into messages. You are elsewhere, they write. You are the memory of now. The last poem I'm going to read, I wrote last autumn on an 8-hour boat ride across Cambodia. And it was basically a glorified dinghy. And I put all my possessions in the cargo bin. And they were... my bag contained my laptop and all the clothes that I was going to wear for the next 11 months. And an hour into the ride, I checked the cargo bin, and my bag was gone. And I did have a few pieces of cash and a pen and some scraps. And so, believing that I'd lost all my possessions, I wrote this. Louisa Whitman's Lullaby to Infant Walt. Fresh from the other place, still wet, the sky no longer moonless, you remember well the black, unchanging tides from which you fell, evicted from that ocean into I. Imperfect home, you know, why ever else would this raw peeling colonize your lungs? Each as a lone candlefish flung, gasping upon a bank of drying shells. That peeling is the only honest sound, vowel of a language ours will teach you to resign. Dauntless, you will pursue in ours what ours, as yet, has never found, that sea still innocent of speech, where everything is you. Thank you.
Thank you, Lindsay. Jeannie Vanasco is a 2014 Emerging Poets Fellow at Poets House. Her writing has appeared in The Believer, a McSweeney's anthology, Tin House, and elsewhere. She's writing a memoir involving a necronym, psychosis, and an artificial eye. She's also working on a book of prose poems and collages. Please welcome Jeannie Vanasco.
Hi, thank you. I just want to say, it's really hard to be a writer without a book. So any recognition along the way, it's so meaningful, especially to young women who I think often need more confidence. So I just want to say how grateful I am. I'm going to start with a poem by Amy, an image for William Carlos. The night is a string of silver, silent stallions grazing red scapes under a charred sky. Slowing and stumbling, they are hurled into grave labyrinths. Who spoke? From gnarled, snarled trees, the herd has emerged. The sky is a sheet of brittle black bones, and the red softened by the cool promise of water. I love that poem. Okay, so I hope you'll indulge me. I'm just going to read a few very short pages from a book that I'm in the process of finally finishing. It's a lyric memoir for my dad. And really the way that I've kind of composed it is it's held together by a sound. So even though there's spare language and white space, I think mostly it is very influenced by poetry because of this one sound, I. So it's called The Glass Eye. And the organizing principle in my mind is the eye, E-Y-E. My father lost his left eye to a rare disease when I was 4, and he had to get an artificial eye. When I was 8, I learned I was named after a dead sibling, a daughter he lost, a half-sister of mine. But he added the letter I to my name and never explained it. And then finally, it sounds sort of trite, but the first person I of memoir exploring who we are, perhaps as a result of grief. So these eyes almost forming an equation. So I'm just going to read 3 very, very short sections from that and then some prose poems. The Glass Eye. My parents and I were playing a game we called the memory game. The goal was to find among all the cards 2 that matched. I was 4. It was my father's turn. I waited what felt like a long time for him to choose a card when, finally, I turned 1 over for him, an open door with nothing on the other side. What am I looking for? He said. I could see him as he looked at me, looking as if he were looking through me. My mother and I followed him to a mirror and watched him close 1 eye, then the other. When the right eye closed, I disappeared. I closed my right eye, he said, and I can't see Jeannie. I closed my left eye, then my right, in that game of illusions that moves objects, moving my father an inch each time. I remember almost nothing before the memory game. It is as if my life begins there. Years of it are full of shadows, but the night I disappeared is full of light. And yet, not until he died 14 Novembers later did my memory of that night return. By then, he had lost his left vocal cord, his left eye, part of his intestines. For cause of death, the coroner wrote throat cancer. He had to write something, my mother says. I also have to write something, but I refuse to simplify. My father deserves so much more. Almost every day, my mother and I talk on the phone, and almost every day we talk about my father. She still lives in Ohio in the house he died in. I live in New York, not far from the house where he was born. He died more than 10 years ago. Just as I have no idea why he died exactly, he had so many things wrong with him, my mother tells me. I have no idea why he lost his eye. Degenerative eye disease, maybe, she says on the phone. advanced glaucoma, the doctor said it happens to something like 1 in 1 million people. What happened exactly? Your dad's tear ducts were closed and clotted with blood, and the doctors couldn't get them to drain. I don't know what you call it. Try to remember. I can't. And then now I'm just going to read some prose poems that I wrote thinking I could get out of my head and I would just write about something entirely different, but pretty soon you'll see almost all the characters of my prose poems didn't have dads, so it's kind of hard to escape your obsessions, I suppose. So this one's called The Chamber. After he turns off the stars, the dictator curls up in bed like a comma and dreams in prehistoric paintings. They are the best he can do. By day in his palace, he sketches work camps in charcoal, captures the stick figures perfectly, his advisors say. It's all in the steady hand, he replies. But now, in bed, the crude image of his own fist follows him along cave walls. Under his soft sheets, the dictator kicks like a sleeping bloodhound on the chase. Fatherless boy takes to his telescope. The stars once looked like small explosions. Maybe they were explosions. How do stars work? He was told once but is forgotten. He seems to remember explosions. After the dictator declared war, the boy's dad disappeared with the stars. A scroll of small homes on winds along a distant hill. The boy pretends their lit windows are stars. He sleeps with light. Okay. Father figure. Again, I wrote these thinking it was a break. Father figure. The dictator's picture hangs above the boy's bed as required by law. I slammed that ball out of the park, he tells it. I got a 98 on my spelling test, he tells it. You look like my dad, he tells it. With his thick cartoonish mustache and pale doughy face, the dictator looks nothing like the boy's father. So long ago, strange men dragged his father from the living room to the street to somewhere else. The next day, the boy's mother gave him a dog. My dad is my dog, he tells it. It opens its mouth, it barks, it throws off light. My dad will come back, it says. The dictator declares another war. He closes his eyes and spins his globe. His finger lands on water. He spins again, more water. The enemy is in the ocean, he warns his citizens. His military ships fire torpedoes at nothing. Nothing fires back. The nation must fight something, his advisors tell him. So the dictator spins his globe until his finger lands on his land. The enemy is in our midst, he warns his citizens. He sends lawyers to his generals. The lawyers advise who can and cannot be killed. Innocent civilians can be killed, provided sections 1, 4, 19, 23, 423, C clauses 194, 3, 17, 348, 421, respectively. Peaceful protesters can be killed, provided sections 2, 9, and 41, C clauses 5, 2, and 9, respectively. Birds can be killed, provided section 132, clause 956. The legal documents grow as big as tanks. Extinct birds fly underground. And classified. A secret list of enemies exists, journalists report. No one can obtain the list of enemies, journalists report. The phones are being tapped, journalists report. Some journalists disappear, no one reports. The diet secrets of the new beautiful heiress are revealed, journalists report. The telephone poles tell secrets to one another. And then I'll end with this one, art lesson. The butcher teaches anatomy to children. Sunday afternoons, they crowd his back room where chickens hang like chandeliers. This week's topic, the skeletal system of puppies. The tallest boy cries. He spent his Saturday posting lost dog signs around town. No one will ever find your dog, the butcher says, unless you can draw him accurately. Now start with the ribs. He hands the boy a stack of fresh butcher paper. The boy presses his pencil so hard he chips the lead. Idea. To capture the town's attention, make wings. Thank you.
So, thank you all, Jerry, Alexandra, Lindsay, and Jeannie, and also Katie. And special thanks to Kimiko Han, and again to Paula and Ed for making this possible. There is food and drink over there. There are magazines, and there are books where? Also there, and bookmarks for Kimiko's new book. Thank you all very much for coming. Please stay and enjoy, and hope to see some of you next year. Thanks.